This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Monday, January 20th. When the impeachment trial begins at 1 o'clock tomorrow, the first thing they'll do is organize the rules. If it goes like the Clinton impeachment, each side would have 24 hours to make their opening arguments. That could be about 10 afternoons of arguments. Then each side would have 16 hours for senators to ask questions of the lawyers for each side. Probably only then would there be a vote on witnesses or additional documents. The marquee news over the weekend, as you probably heard, was that Trump has named Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz and Clinton impeachment prosecutor Ken Starr to his legal team. Dershowitz previewed his role yesterday on CNN's State of the Union.
I'm making what could be the most important argument on the floor of the Senate, namely that even if everything that is alleged by the House managers is proven or taken as true, they would not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. I will be paraphrasing the successful argument made by Justice Benjamin Curtis in the trial of Andrew Johnson back in the 1860s, where he argued that the framers intended for impeachable conduct only to be criminal-like conduct.
Alan Dershowitz yesterday. With me now is Time Magazine congressional correspondent Alana Abramson, who is following the impeachment proceedings. Hi, Alana. Thanks for coming on.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me this morning.
Can you explain where Dershowitz and Starr fit into the president's overall defense strategy?
Yeah, so for the majority of this process, the White House has actually declined to participate. They were given an opportunity during the Judiciary Committee and did not appear. The White House Counsel's Office has largely been helming this process. But on Friday, the White House announced that they had hired additional members of their team to present their arguments for why Trump should not be removed from office at the upcoming Senate trial. And that includes Starr, Dershowitz, and Robert Ray.
In the clip we just played, Dershowitz says his argument will be about not rising to the level of impeachment, even if it's all true. Do you know how he'll make that case?
We don't know how he'll make that case. So the White House originally filed a 7-page response to the House's brief, which was filed on Saturday. And Dershowitz was actually not on that response. It was just two other White House counsel attorneys. But that response didn't necessarily say a ton about why it's not impeachable. It was more focusing on the fact that the House's arguments as a whole were completely invalid. So it sounds a little bit like Dershowitz is going for a bit more nuanced argument than what was presented on Saturday evening by the White House.
In the clip we played, Dershowitz says what his role will be, making the case that even if Trump did everything he's accused of, it doesn't rise to the level of impeachment under the Constitution. What role will Ken Starr play if that's as known?
Ken Starr, I think, will be likely front and center at the trial. I think you'll see him giving the arguments on behalf of the White House and the president and arguing that this is not impeachable conduct, just like Dershowitz will be. The Democrats filed a much more extensive brief on Saturday evening. It was 111 pages and effectively laid out their argument. And overall, I mean, you saw some new information, but their argument mostly remains the same, that Trump abused the power of his office through his call with the Ukrainian president and that he subsequently obstructed Congress and that he's, you know, a danger to the Republic and his behavior warrants removal from office.
Do the Democrats believe that Adam Schiff and Jerry Nadler and the five other impeachment managers can be as effective on TV as Dershowitz and Ken Starr, who are, you know, larger than life figures on Fox News and elsewhere? I'm curious how the appointment of these two marquee names has shaken up the Democrats' approach, if at all.
I don't really think it's shaken up their approach. I mean, I think they always thought the White House was going to continue to push back on their arguments. I think that Pelosi probably had in mind that the White House was going to ultimately craft a strong legal team when she picked these managers, which is why she picked this group of seven people who, you know, are very schooled in the facts. Schiff and Nadler have helmed the process so far. They know the arguments they're making. The majority of them hold law degrees. So I think, you know, they think that they can give the White House legal team a run for their money.
Alana, what will happen tomorrow? What's the first thing that will happen?
So the first thing that will happen is obviously, you know, the senators will file into the chamber, and then John Roberts, the Chief Justice, will call the proceedings to order. And at that point, all we really know is that there will be a debate on the rules shaping the contours of the trial. So McConnell has said that he wants to emulate the rules from Bill Clinton's 1999 impeachment trial, but has yet to actually show the text of what his rules will look like. We presume that as soon as everyone's convened, we will see that resolution.
We've been hearing that Democratic leader Chuck Schumer will force a number of votes in this initial debate over the rules. What can he do even without having the majority?
He can basically be an annoyance to McConnell, to put it a little bit bluntly. I mean, he can force as many votes as possible to try and make his point from a rhetorical perspective about what he thinks should happen with the trial. He needs the majority of senators to pass whatever votes he's forcing. And it's probably unlikely that he will get that, but he will still make his intentions known and can broadcast to the public what he's trying to do.
The length of opening arguments from the Clinton trial, 24 hours for each side's opening argument. Is that what McConnell wants for this? Because I've also read that he may want to cut that in half to 12 and 12.
So again, we don't really know what McConnell will do tomorrow because we have not seen the text of his resolution. But yes, if he's going by the Clinton precedent, then each side gets 24 hours. There's concern, though, that if they give each side 24 hours, Senator David Perdue said on NBC yesterday that they could cram it into 2 days of 12-hour arguments, which would effectively mean that because the trial starts at 1, it would go until midnight, 1 a.m. And Democrats are not happy with that. They said that that is basically covering up the process so the public can't see it. So we do know vaguely that if McConnell adheres to the Clinton precedent, that there will be 24 hours for each side, but we don't know the number of days that it'll be stretched out over.
Yeah, because presumably, if it is 24 hours and they do just follow the 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. schedule that they followed during Clinton, that's like 5 hours a day for 5 days for each side on the schedule that they would be keeping. Why would it take that long just for opening arguments in the first place?
The trial is effectively trying to persuade the senators who are the jurors, but it's also trying to persuade public opinion. So, you know, they really have the court during those 24 hours. And it makes the most sense for them to maximize on that and use all of that solely to prove the arguments that they're trying to make. If it's stretched out over 4 days, they essentially have all of those days to make their case. And I think that maximizes public attention.
And then the 16 hours of senators submitting questions, if it goes like the Clinton process, how would that work?
Again, it's all kind of confusing because we don't know what McConnell will say in his text, but the senators would submit written questions, and then I believe that from there, they could decide which ones would be heard. But their questions would all be written.
On the question of witnesses, here's Dershowitz again on CNN yesterday.
The one thing the Constitution would require is if witnesses are called on one side, they have to be called on the other side. What I would think is wait until after all the opening arguments are made. Let's see if witnesses are called for. And if they are, the trial will take a much longer time because the Democrats will call John Bolton. The president will invoke executive privilege. It will have to go to the courts. The courts will resolve it.
So, Alana, there are two coming controversies in that one clip. Witness reciprocity, you might call it, if the Democrats get to call Bolton or whoever, then the Republicans get to call witnesses of their choice. We know they want Hunter Biden, maybe the whistleblower, maybe Joe Biden. And then there's the question of executive privilege and John Bolton. Can you talk about that one? Dershowitz makes it sound in that clip like Bolton will never testify in this proceeding because his appearance will get tied up in the courts until well after it's done. Is that a given?
I think it could actually go either way. I think the White House could invoke an executive privilege. I think that Bolton would likely get taken to the higher courts. But I think there are probably some legal people out there who could argue that Bolton maybe still be able to testify. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not completely familiar with the arguments. But I don't necessarily know if it's a given that we won't hear from Bolton.
But now here's Ken Starr with the Trump Team Now back in 1999 when he was prosecuting Clinton.
With respect to this phase of the investigation, the administration has been uncooperative. To the contrary, it has litigated numerous issues. It may very well be that the considered judgment of this body is any privilege can be invoked, no matter how unmeritorious one thinks it is, that that's not an abuse. I disagree with that.
Ken Starr arguing against executive privilege in that trial in which he was the prosecutor in 1999. But there are also contradictions on the other side as well. Chuck Schumer argued against witnesses in 1999. Do the contradictions on either side matter to the politics of now or to what actually happens in this proceeding?
I mean, I think they matter in the sense that each side will use the other one's contradictions to prove their own points. But in terms of what it actually means for what happens in the trial, I don't think it matters at all. I think that Ken Starr could easily still argue to invoke executive privilege regarding Bolton, and, you know, Schumer and the Democrats may say, look what he said 20 years ago, but ultimately it won't matter.
Hillary in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Hillary.
Hello. My 2 points. First of all, what you said at the outset, Brian, about Ken Starr and Dershowitz being the star defense attorneys or whatever. They're both tainted individuals. Starr with this Baylor University.
Yes, he was the president of Baylor University. Yeah. And for people who don't know this, it's a great irony considering that he prosecuted Clinton for things related to the affair with Monica Lewinsky. He had to resign as president of Baylor University because he was seen as not tough enough on sexual misconduct taking place on campus.
Yes. And Dershowitz has been implicated in the Jeffrey Epstein sex abuse issue, which I don't know whether he's been proven guilty in that or...
Well, he was a lawyer.
But he was one of the people who, it's been said that he was one of the patrons of Epstein's business model.
Hillary, thank you for your call. And on that, this is a Washington Post article from November 8th, headline, Alan Dershowitz countersues accuser in Jeffrey Epstein case. And it starts, Harvard Law professor Alan Dershowitz accused by a woman of sexually assaulting her when she was a teenager under the control of sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein has now sued the woman in federal court in New York, claiming that her allegations are lies, disparagement, defamation, harassment that are beyond the bounds of decency and not tolerated in civilized society. Those words from Dershowitz's suit. So, Alana and everybody, there's a little bit of background on the accusation against Alan Dershowitz and the suits and countersuits that have arisen in recent months since. And I guess the question on the table right now is, how does any of that affect the impeachment trial of Donald Trump? Do you think it might, one way or the other, in the court of public opinion?
I don't. I mean, I think that the only way I think it could possibly impact the trial is if Dershowitz's role in all of this becomes overwhelming and supersedes coverage of the trial. And then I think, you know, we might be in different territory, but I don't really think it will matter. I mean, I think the people who already believe Trump should not be removed from office likely won't be swayed based on Dershowitz's prior cases. And I think that the people who think that he should be removed from office will just be like, okay, this is another, you know, feather in the hat.
It could be that people retreat to their corners, as in the case of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, with respect to who they believe. And, you know, from a political analysis standpoint, I'm guessing that Trump figures this will benefit him. Because, again, all he needs to do is keep Fox News viewers buying enough of his talking points and enough of the narrative of who the aggrieved parties are, in this case, he might say himself and Alan Dershowitz, that there won't be enough of a change of public opinion in states with Republican senators that they'll have to flip and convict.
I think that's right. I mean, I think the White House's entire strategy this whole time has been maximize the base, make sure that no one on the base ever thinks he should be removed from office. And I think we're seeing that. I think that, you know, support among Republicans for Trump has remained solid throughout this process.
David in Englewood. David, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling.
Yes, I want to make three points. I'll make them very quick. And one is that I don't see how people can really take this seriously when you have Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, signing a document and then handing out the pens as if this were some kind of carnival. This is some kind of celebratory mode. Now, secondly, the House conducted focus groups on what words to use and what would go over with the public. I mean, this is a serious matter. And yet, it's taken like, oh, well, this is a joke. And thirdly, I don't see how you can defame any lawyer for taking a client. I mean, it's not Alan Dershowitz's view that everybody deserves competent counsel, no matter how bad a person they are. I think that's in the Constitution, I believe. And so if any one of us was accused of a crime, no matter how bad it was, we're entitled to counsel before we can be proven guilty. And by the way, why doesn't anyone ever talk about George Stephanopoulos? Wasn't he one of the people that attended a party when Epstein was released from prison?
I'm not familiar with the George Stephanopoulos case, but of course, all kinds of people, Bill Clinton, all kinds of people are getting tarred by their associations with Jeffrey Epstein. David, let me ask you a question as a Trump supporter in this case.
Well, no, I am a conservative.
But you don't think that he should be removed from office, I take it.
I don't think that this reaches that level. I didn't think that Clinton's articles reached the level of removal. I mean, removal from office is something, I mean, that should be reserved for like the worst of the worst. I mean, politicians lie every day. So no, I don't think Clinton or this rises to that level. And the way it's been conducted is ridiculous.
David, thank you for your call. Call us again. So, Alana, let me go back to you on some of the points that David raised. From an image perspective with respect to Pelosi and the Democrats, that incident with the pens, what exactly happened there? Were you aware of that?
Yeah, so I was actually in the room when Pelosi signed the articles, and I noticed that there were these pens, and I asked one of the staffers, and they just said, you know, this is routine. She has pens at most signings. I know that Twitter kind of went crazy because they handed out pens to each of the impeachment managers. But I do think that overall, Pelosi has worked very hard to strike a very solemn tone during these proceedings. As someone who's watched them from the beginning, I mean, you saw that she basically shushed people when they were cheering during the actual impeachment process last year in December. And I think that she's made it very clear that she does not think this is a celebratory thing. She does not think that her caucus should be acting like it's a celebratory thing. I mean, you saw Hakeem Jeffries on Fox yesterday saying it was a very sober moment. None of us really wanted to be doing this. So I think that the pens shouldn't be looked at in isolation.
Let me take one more call. Nick, you're on the air. Hi, Nick. Thank you for calling in.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. Two quick points. I think Nancy Pelosi should have chosen Justin Amash as one of the managers. He was a former Republican, and he's one of the most eloquent, articulate spokesmen in favor of Trump's impeachment. So I think Nancy Pelosi made a mistake there. I also think Democrats should take any deal to get John Bolton to testify. If Republicans want Hunter and Joe Biden, they should. Hunter and Joe should testify. They helped get us in this mess with their behavior with Ukraine. I don't think they did anything illegal, but I just think Biden should not get a free pass. If Republicans want Biden to get Bolton, I say take the deal.
Nick, thank you very much. Alana, let's take both of his points before we run out of time. On Justin Amash, you certainly could make a case that Justin Amash, who left the Republican Party over this, would have been a very strong impeachment manager. Why isn't he there?
I think Pelosi didn't select him. There were several moderate Democrats who came up with this idea to push Amash as an impeachment manager, and ultimately Pelosi decided that was not the way she was going to go. She did not select him as part of the group, and I think she's very happy with the group she's assembled.
Even at the same time on the other side, Dershowitz, again on TV, I believe in the past he has said, I didn't vote for Donald Trump. I'm not a Trump supporter. He's got a reputation as a liberal, at least on some things in the past. And so Trump is playing that card, but Pelosi isn't.
I think you can look at it that way. I would argue that Dershowitz might be viewed as more polarizing and more, at least more well, maybe because he's more well known than Amash. But I don't really think that anyone would point at Trump's legal team and say, look at this bipartisan group that he's assembled.
Fair enough. And on the other question of either of the Bidens testifying, we've had calls on this show from a few people now who've said Joe Biden didn't do anything wrong. The callers don't believe, but he should testify. Go ahead, use it as leverage to force Bolton's testimony or whoever's on the other side, and let the Republicans, you know, fruitlessly question him, trying to prove some kind of corruption that doesn't exist. And to this caller's point, thereby allowing Joe Biden to get them out of the mess that on some level he helped get them into by his son Hunter taking that role.
Yeah, so McConnell has said that he said at his press conference last week that he would be open to the idea of witness reciprocity. Democrats have been pretty clear that they don't think Hunter Biden can offer much in the way of facts on the investigation, and that he would essentially just kind of be a showpiece for the Republicans to question and, you know, raise ratings, essentially. But Joe Biden has not been mentioned as much. They did lay out explicitly in a brief that Joe Biden, you know, there nothing has ever been proven that he did anything wrong. He was just following the U.S.-Ukrainian policy during his work under Obama. So I will see what happens, but Democrats have been very clear that they don't think Hunter Biden would offer a lot.
Alana Abramson, Time Magazine congressional correspondent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.